This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Russell, and today we have BFM's very own Lee Trilin.
Hello.
Hello, great to have you back. And also we have the return of Pusaka CEO. I had this problem with that in. Pauline Phan.
Hello there.
Why don't you tell us, what do you do?
I'm creative director. I thought you knew that.
For Pusaka, and tell the world one more time, what does Pusaka do?
Pusaka is an organization that works with cultural heritage and specifically traditional performing arts in the country.
And our three topics this week are, topic number one is JOLO, the movie. Topic number two, is sensitivity valued? And finally, topic number three is improvisation. So with topic number one, I and most of Malaysia, but not you, Pauline, I know, have been reading The Billion Dollar Whale. Mm-hmm. Have you read it?
No, not just yet.
Okay, all right. Well, there are going to be some spoiler alerts.
That's fine.
We already know how this ends, in a sense, kind of.
Okay. So obviously it's the story of, I think, pretty much the biggest heist in history, where Malaysia's very own JOLO stole... And I'm getting it all the wrong way around. I can't really say that. But anyway, he received an enormous amount of money and he spent an enormous amount of money. And things are now happening. People are being arrested here. People who you may have heard of, ex-Prime Minister. So I was thinking as I was reading the book, the news came through that the movie rights had been purchased and by Michelle Yeoh, amongst others. And I was thinking, JOLO. Is JOLO a good enough character to be a protagonist in a movie? Because as I'm reading it, the story is, it comes across as just this, I don't know, 13-year-old boy who has the tastes of a 13-year-old boy who receives all the money in the world and then just spends it on nightclubs and stuff. And it's just a repeat and rinse, repeat. And it's just like, actually, in a way, as a movie, this would be a very boring movie.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think JOLO functions best as he is right now. Sort of international man of not quite mystery, where he continues to be somebody that we seek and pursue and we know, you know, only as a concept. I think that is how he is best used as a protagonist. I would watch that film. If, however, we were watching the rise of a strange Chinese boy from Penang who decided, I have a lot of money, I'm going to buy all the stereotypical things I can buy, that I think is a less intriguing film.
Mm. One long shopping spree.
Exactly. Yeah. JOLO in absentia. Great. So, protagonist.
Okay, well then what makes a protagonist? What do we require?
I think you need a level of complexity in any protagonist, yeah. I mean, there's certainly things in a protagonist, whether in a movie or in a novel, I think you need to somehow relate to the audience or the reader. But besides just being black and white, protagonists are very boring, I think. Mm. If it's either good or bad, villain or hero, I think a really intriguing protagonist has to have some kind of complexity, has to have some kind of secret, has to have something that you're still figuring out as you're watching or reading.
I think a rich inner life, right? Yeah. Because that matters, and that seems to be what's lacking in, I haven't read the book, but your description of book JOLO, there doesn't seem to be an inner life. There doesn't seem to be inner motivations. I think I don't have to understand your motivations, but I should know them. Mm. And I think having that helps me stay invested in your story, whatever it is.
Because if I think of the movies of Martin Scorsese, which I think is apropos, Goodfellas and The Wolf of Wall Street, in Goodfellas, you have a central character who is... attracted to, at the beginning of the movie, he's attracted to the life of the gangster, which we have grown up thinking is an unattractive, ugly, villainous thing. But he's attracted to it. As the movie progresses, he loves the life and then he starts to fall out of the love. And the other characters turn on him. So he is conflicted in that, you know, his survival is at stake and people who were once friends become enemies. There's fear in there. I don't know if the JOLO story has a shift in character from a position of A to a position of B.
There's no arc is what you're saying.
There's no arc. Yeah. He's just A the whole way.
Mm. Yeah, right. There's no conflict. Inner turmoil. It doesn't seem like that on the surface anyway.
So while I'm going through the story of this heist, I'm thinking of other characters who might be protagonists. Now, in the book, one of the fatal flaws of the book is that Claire Rucastle Brown and Sarawak Report is not mentioned. Mm-hmm. Which is sort of okay, that's a bit odd. But you might be able to hang a movie on her a little bit more, because then she would be piecing a puzzle together, mm-hmm. a sort of detective. And you know, we like to see that.
Mm.
And if you upped the danger, the perceived danger that she might have been in,
mm.
maybe mm-hmm. there. There's the character of Justo, the Swiss fella who right. turned whistleblower.
Mm-hmm.
So he starts off as being part of the scam. He gets pushed out of the scam and then decides to take revenge, become a whistleblower.
Again, great motivations.
Maybe more.
I am thinking, though, whether or not we need a protagonist when a story is so interesting in and of itself. Or, you know, even if you have an incredibly boring person at the center of something who then serves as the impetus for greater stories, do we then need a protagonist if the story itself is, you know, so interesting? I read an article recently about a woman named Anna Delvey. Have either of you heard of her?
No.
Yeah, there's a reason. She's very dull. But but the article was fascinating because she basically scammed, I don't know, half, three quarters of New York's artsy rich. So who move in galleries, people who move in moving paintings, in having art parties.
People are
like
waiting
that.
To be scammed. Yeah.
She had no money. She came from nowhere. She had no friends. And just by sort of placing herself in the right parties, by dropping hints as to the kinds of money that she had, never had any, she kind of just made her way through. It's a fascinating article.
But did she get caught?
Yes, she did.
Maybe we need that. We need that conclusion.
No difference. She's just incredibly dull. Speaking to her is like a cipher. You know, she is nothing more than just a weird blonde cipher within this article.
Well, maybe that's what Jolo is as well. He's a reflection of other people's wants. And I guess maybe the people swirling around him and their ambitions.
And then you learn how to maneuver in those circles very well. I think it's reflective of that.
I think the scam is the protagonist.
Yeah. Well, you know, the movie rights have been purchased apparently, and we're hoping, fingers crossed, last week's guest Jason Leong will get the role of Jolo. And if not he, then obviously Scarlett Johansson. And she'll be fantastic.
You know what? She's going to be so great.
Yeah.
Or at least she'll believe it.
Well, Meryl Streep, my God, she can play anyone. Has she ever played a Chinese guy from Penang? We don't know. So we move on now to topic number two, which is, Lynn, is sensitivity undervalued?
Yeah. So we've had, I guess, a little, you know, a few discussions about what that term means. And I suppose I'm using it loosely to describe someone who is sensitive to feelings, sensitive to stimuli, who's responsive to that. And the topic came to mind because while I was watching Hannah Gadsby's Nanette, which is on Netflix and which is extremely good, in which she, you know, dwells on a number of things, sexual abuse among others, sexism. There's a lot, but what she said at one point really struck me, and it was when somebody told her to stop being so sensitive, and her response was, why is insensitivity something to strive for? I happen to know that my sensitivity is my strength. I know that. It's my sensitivity that's helped me to stop being so sensitive. And so when someone tells me to stop being so sensitive, I feel a little bit like a nose being lectured by a fart, not the problem. And I just wanted to kind of dwell on that, whether or not, because I have been told, you know, stop being so sensitive. I think people who think of themselves as sensitive have been told that also. Mm. And it sometimes can make you feel, I think, remarkably undervalued, especially in professional settings where people tell you, we need to move on now, stop being so sensitive. In friendships and relationships where your sensitivity is sort of unspoken emotional labor because you're making things easier for everyone. But when you're upset, stop being so sensitive. So, yeah, I just wanted to kind of bring that up.
Well, Pauline, you work with a lot of artists and I'm an artist myself, by the way.
Are you now?
Aren't we all?
Yeah. I mean, none of us work in merchant banking, okay?
Yes,
let's put it like that.
So
we've been exposed to sensitivity.
Well, yes. I think sensitivity, I mean, I personally value sensitivity in most contexts, including the work context, but I think there are lines that can be drawn in terms of, I mean, I don't appreciate when things in a professional relationship, for example, if people take things personally when it's not supposed to be personal, that can be maybe interpreted as being oversensitive in a certain way. But in terms of a sensitivity to your particular craft and a sensitivity to your particular context and what you're and the people you're working with, especially because the work we do is with communities, you need to be sensitive to those communities. And if you're not, then you can't really work in this in with traditional arts, because it takes that kind of sensitivity to understand where the other is coming from.
Are we using one word to describe many, many different things? I mean, are we talking about, this is empathy? This is politeness? I don't know. This is being aware of stimuli, as you said, and allowing that to have an effect upon you?
Sure. I mean, I think it's a number of things. I think it's an umbrella term that describes a number of different emotions and a number of different reactions. And I think that point about oversensitivity is really interesting, because I do think that you can be oversensitive. Of course you can. You know, if you can be sensitive, you can be over or under. It's just a descriptive phrase. And yet, I think for sensitive people, very often it feels as if that phrase is almost a cudgel. And so it's very hard to draw the lines of where that fairness comes in. And I don't know. I've just been mulling it over, simply because I see it happen time and time again of people who have, you know, good suggestions born of sensitivity that they would not have had were they not sensitive to their surroundings. And that is appreciated. But the thing that drove them to that conclusion, that doesn't get appreciated. So it's interesting, especially in a workplace setting.
I find in the arts one area where, dare I say, sensitivity is a problem for everybody, for the subject and the people working around, is when it's really important to be able to make a distinction between yourself, your inner being, who you are, and the work.
Yes, absolutely.
And these are two very different things. I mean, you've put your heart and soul into the work, but it is not ultimately, well, it can, it could be you, but in order to then put it out into the world and to work with other people, you need to find a gap, a distance between the two. Otherwise, anybody says anything about that, you fall to pieces. And then the work never gets...
No, absolutely. And then you're immune to, you don't, you're not open to critical, constructive criticism or anything. You might take every kind of criticism as a kind of attack. Or and, kind of negation.
And I think that's part of the creative process, right? Yeah. Learning to kind of give birth to something and then accept it as separate to you to a degree. But I also notice it, I think, in management settings where if somebody perhaps has a more sensitive style of management, by which I mean you might be sensitive to more different types of people, you might be more giving to different types of people, that can sometimes get overlooked because... Where are my results?
Yes.
Right? And then...
I agree with that.
Yeah. So in a results-oriented workplace, of which I think most workplaces are, that value, I think, gets lost in the midst of it.
Is this a male-female thing?
I don't think so. I don't think it's a male-female thing. I think it's it really depends on the context in which you're working. And I mean, I see that for sure in... In our kind of work, it's not so results-oriented. I mean, not something you can quantify anyway. And sometimes when we work, when we interface with things, people from the corporate sector, for example, who are all about figures and quantifying and monetizing, and I mean, those two worlds sometimes just don't meet. And you do have, and sometimes we see our work as, you know, we are sensitive, but, you know, we are trying to be constructive and try to kind of support traditional communities and or communities of artists who are doing things in different ways and can't necessarily be monetized. And some of those results happen over 5 or 10 years, not in a 1 year, 6 month graph that you can chart.
Well, I think the three of us, and in fact, most people, whether you know it or not, we work in the arts and especially the entertainment industry.
Culture, please.
Well, you can call it that.
Thank you very much.
All right, but it is about grabbing people's attention. Not necessarily the whole world. I mean, maybe one portion. And even if you're in a bank and you've got a new product, I mean, whatever it is, you need to get people's attention.
Yeah.
And in order to be able to execute that, you have to, I think, in a way, live on the edge of your emotions and your sensitivity at all times. You've got to be open to everything so that you can sense what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah.
Mm. So I suppose there, that being said, then maybe occasionally being perceived as oversensitive, or if others think, wow, I work with the most oversensitive person, that's kind of the price of admission for getting work out of your sensitive friends and colleagues sometimes.
Right. Well, I don't want to upset you,
Lynn. I don't appreciate that tone of voice.
Okay. Anyway, we're going to move on. So that's just the way it is.
Results-oriented here at A Bit of Culture.
That's right. We've got time limits around here. So in a moment, we shall have I'm terrified now that I may have upset things. In a moment, we shall be moving on to topic number three here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Lee Chui Lin, and Pauline Fan. And now, Pauline, topic number three, improvisation.
Yes. I've been thinking a lot about the art of improvisation over the past few weeks, particularly because we've just brought in a group of very wonderful Persian musicians, classical musicians, and who did a concert at the Islamic Arts Museum.
I saw it. It was absolutely fantastic.
Yes, yes. And this was the marvelous Kehan Kalhor, Grammy Award-winning Comanche player. And he was accompanied by Kia and Zia Tabassian, who were playing setar and tombak, respectively. But it was... I spent about 2 weeks with them every day, really kind of immersed and also learning a lot. I already had read, of course, and I have seen Kehan play many times, but I really kind of immersed myself in this incredible universe of Persian music. And Persian classical music, the core essence of it is improvisation. And that's something, of course, usually when we think about improvisation musically, I think the first thing that comes to our mind is jazz. For most of us. It is something that I also encounter in the traditional performing arts quite a lot, especially in Malay traditional performing arts, and also in even my Burmese dance tradition. There's a lot of improvisation in that. But the Persian classical tradition is incredible in its level of improvisation and the kind of heights of artistry that it goes to. But what I think I found the most fascinating, listening in on a lot of the workshops that they were doing, and when Kehan especially was explaining the development of Persian music, it's an incredibly structured thing. I mean, the universe of Persian classical music, while if you're listening to it, it can seem like it's just one long improvisation, and which it is. But what the basis of that and from where they build that from is this incredibly intricate structure, which they call the radif, which means order in Persian. And it is a kind of ordering sort of not really scales, but modes, and modes which they call daska. And within that gushe, which is with these little melodic forms that they have to, each musician has to memorize when they're learning. And it's like 200 gushes at least, maybe 300. It's an incredibly intense period of learning, of mastery, before they can even begin to think about improvising.
Yeah.
And it made me just also think, I mean, we in Malaysia, we do have traditions that do improvise, like the Malay...
Indian classical music?
Yes, Indian classical music for sure. Mm. But even in Malay traditional forms, especially in things like Wayang Kulit, the performing arts, Wayang Kulit, most of the comic scenes are improvised, in Mak Yong as well, and some of the music as well. But I don't think it has the same level or depth.
It doesn't necessarily have a language that's been applied mm-hmm. to it, a classification.
Mm.
It's just reacting to the audience, reading your audience.
It is. I mean, there is, of course, there's the deep training that you do need to undergo to feel comfortable and to master your instrument and to master the vocabulary, maybe of the wayang or the mak yong. But I've always wanted to see, and I'm hoping this is part of the reason why we actually did those workshops, is because I would like to see Malaysian musicians kind of explore a little more of what they can do with their own music and in terms of improvisation. I mean, really kind of explore it sonically.
Do you think that that sort of codification is an integral part of that process of, you know, kind of going to the next level? Or is it specific to this is the culture in which you learn and therefore, you know, that is the code that speaks to you? I'm just curious because I suppose for me, what strikes me is the idea that artistry, you know, when it's romanticized, it tends to be, well, you were born with it and now you're going to go off and be amazing.
Oh, yeah.
And it ignores very often the real work that needs to go into
it,
which is why there's always been the system of, you know, apprenticing to people.
Mm-hmm.
And that period of apprenticing is, as you you know, as you described, the period of intense learning, intense work, and knowing that, look, you master this, and then you begin to think about how you want to create, but you master first.
Mm-hmm.
So is that kind of codification important, do you think?
Well, the thing is, I think if you get too codified, you actually lose the beauty and the subtlety of it. So if things start to get too institutionalized, I think there's a danger of losing touch with that master-disciple element, which I think is so important for the survival of things like Persian music. Like Persian music actually survived because of that system. The guru, well, they called it ustad, and the student, you know. And it was a long time before it actually was institutionalized. And I think it has survived in the form that it has now to such a high form of artistry because it was so much dependent on the oral tradition and on master student. And it even survived the Islamic Republic. I mean, for a while, it wasn't encouraged to perform music in the Islamic Republic, but now it's sort of, I mean, it's coming back.
Performer and audience. I think that the audience it helps if the audience themselves understand the language that is happening before them. Yes. I remember watching Indian classical music here,
yes,
and seeing people counting the time with their hands, yeah, in this very intricate way that I didn't understand. It's like 16
yes,
time,
yes,
or something, really
complicated time.
Complicated, yeah. And I was watching them with envy because I'd love to be able to understand that in a language. And I watched a Persian classical performance in London,
yeah,
a few years back, and all of these London Iranian exiles were there,
yes,
of different generations. They all hated each other. And he starts in a way that they understood.
Mm.
He started with the slow,
yeah,
songs and moved up to, by the end, of just incredible frenetic,
yeah,
frenzy.
Yeah.
And the audience were on their feet,
mm-hmm,
because they knew the language. They knew what was coming, but also it spoke of the culture of their homeland,
yes,
from which they were exiled.
Yeah.
I was watching it outside looking in, and I was enjoying the audience as much as the music.
Yeah, yeah.
But I could never understand that inner language.
Mm.
And I think you need perhaps hundreds of years. I mean, you know, jazz.
Mm.
Jazz doesn't, I don't get it. But the, I'm sorry, but
oh,
you know.
God, Cam.
No, I
how
don't
do you live?
Because I was not raised hearing those sounds or understanding there was an inner language. So now if I did it, it would be sitting down with a notepad and learning. It wouldn't really speak to me in the way that it speaks to.
You don't like Billie Holiday?
Yeah, okay, I like Billie Holiday.
Oh, boy.
As much as the next guy. Don't look at me like that. Yeah, I like Billie Holiday.
I'm
We don't need that. I mean, if you understand the language, it helps resonate more.
No, absolutely, which is why I think a part of it is also audience education.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so important to actually educate or at least expose our audience to deeper ways of listening. Because I think, and very often, you know, what makes me a little bit disappointed is because I think there are so many talented musicians here and so many talented performers, but I think they get very easily comfortable. And even in terms of experimentation and exploring new forms or new avenues of creativity, I think sometimes they get a little bit stuck because, and partly it's because the audience is quite happy with something a little bit superficial, which I think, I mean, I think that's very disruptive.
I would imagine that,
yeah,
that Malaysian music, popular music, etc., is far more syncretic than anything in Persia.
It is far more syncretic, but what the danger of that is that the superficial approach to that is just to make it multicultural. To throw a Malay instrument, to throw it in Chinese instrument, and to throw an Indian instrument together and call that, oh, okay, something Malaysian. And it's totally superficial. It's been done a million times.
But a Malaysian audience would hear and understand that.
I don't know
if
that's
nothing,
true.
I think there's nothing to be understood beyond the fact that there's a kind of jumble of multicultural.
I mean, I think also, and that's why, I mean, when we talk about, earlier we talked about trying to define sensitivity as such, but I think trying to define the parameters of what we're talking about in terms of improvisation is so important too, because that description of, well, we'll just play, you know, three separate instruments that aren't usually played together.
Exactly.
To some people, that is regarded as improvisation.
Yes.
That might even be the very height of improvisation.
For me, it's not. I mean, for me, improvisation is really when you are doing something musically and really exploring something in a musical sense, not just in terms of throwing something together. And it's not jamming either. I mean, jamming is something a bit different.
And as we're talking about all this, I think it also comes down to our ability to listen. I mean, not just to understand, but to listen.
Absolutely.
Because so much of being able to improvise is listening
responding. It is. And that's exactly a point that Kehan made, you know, that before you even learn how to play, and the best musicians are the best listeners, you can't be a good musician and a good improviser if you're not listening to who you're playing with.
And on that note...
Oh, nicely
done. Thank you. Because I'm sensitive to these things.
Indeed.
Yeah. I have no doubt. Really.
We will move on, though, to the final part of the show, recommendations, where we recommend something that we think might be of interest, and I go first. So, so you two, do you ever find yourself asking yourself, yes, but what about the Italian front during the First World War? And you sort of think, 14 battles of Isonzo? I mean, what's that about?
It keeps me up at night.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I know, Lynn. But now all your questions can be answered. Because I kind of stopped reading the Whale of Wolf of Wales. What do you call it? The Billion Dollar Whale. Because one, it got a little bit repetitive. Like, steal money, spend money, steal money,
boring
spend
protagonist.
Money. Yeah. And also because I was waiting for a book that I'd ordered on Amazon. And that's one of the most exciting things in life is waiting for your Amazon thing to come. And It's a book called Hell in the Trenches, Austro-Hungarian Stormtroopers and Italian Arditi in the Great War by Paolo Morisi. And it's Lynn, it'll answer all the questions you have about tactics used by the Austrian Austro-Hungarian Stormtroopers and Italian Arditi, and the strategy and the thinking behind it. So so question's going to be answered there. That is my recommendation.
Oh my.
It's a really good book and I'm enjoying it. Also, whilst you're at it, you might be interested in Mark Thompson's The White War, which is a very good overview of the Italian front, which is where Hemingway wrote For Whom the Bells Toll? No. Was it that one? Was that the Spanish War? Anyway, he wrote one of them.
One of those.
Yeah. Hemingway wrote something. So that's my recommendation. And so, Lynn, what's yours?
Well, I mean, after such a mainstream recommendation,
I fear
to go next.
I'm sorry.
Well, I've been watching Maniac on Netflix, and maybe people know Cary Joji Fukunaga, who is the director of all the episodes from his previous work on Beasts of No Nation, True Detective, things like that. But this is very tonally different. I mean, the show is fascinating. It stars Emma Stone and Jonah Hill, and it's all about grief and loneliness and trying to find your way out of that into some form of connection. And it tells the story through telling different stories. So what's interesting about the show, for me anyway, it's rare that you find a TV show that is wholly interested in exploring themes. So it's not interested necessarily in a story. There is no linear story to be told. It's not necessarily interested in exploring genre. It is several genres in one show. It is several recurring characters played by the same actors in one show. It's some fine performances, but mostly it's a sort of meditation on the theme of loss and how you find your way out of that and how you search for shortcuts that may not exist. I'm not done with it yet. I'll see if they stick the landing. But for now, it's a tough watch. The first three episodes are not easy. And it's a very odd show, but I'm enjoying it.
That sounds fantastic.
I can't tell if you mean Italian friend.
I know. It's so hard to impress.
No, I mean that. I mean that I really like True Detective. When it sort of like took steps sideways and it wasn't a slave to the plot, But in doing so, it investigated, it's explored these atmospheres that just never get seen or heard.
In fair warning, the first three or so episodes really are not easy. But after that, it starts to chug along.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. And that's Maniac on Netflix.
Maniac.
Wow. Okay. Pauline.
I want to recommend a book that I am still reading. I picked it up in London this summer, and it's one of the most incredible books I've ever read. It's by a lady by the name of Mercè Rodoreda, and she is a Catalan writer. This was the last novel that she wrote, and the language is just stunning to me. I mean, it's quite a bleak book, and it's quite difficult to figure out because it's not plot driven, and that's one of the aspects I really, really love about this book. It's called Death in Spring. And she wrote it in Catalan. She's considered actually one of the most important Catalan writers.
And you're reading it in Catalan?
No, obviously not in Catalan.
I wouldn't put it past you, Pauline. My expectations are high.
Not yet. Maybe in a couple of years.
Right.
But it revolves around the life of a particular village, and it's not a named village, or it's fictional village, and a teenage boy who's growing up in that village. And the people of that village have the strangest customs, everything from death rites to pregnancy rites to very cruel, actually, cruel and strange, and yet it's just kind of accepted, and that's just the way they do things. And it's all seen through the eyes of this teenage boy. And the entire book is sort of just his experience of life in that village. They have also these scenes of the village. There's a river that flows under a mountain, and every year they send young boys to go and swim upstream, and some of them have their faces torn off. I mean, it's kind of very comedy. Yes, perhaps to you, Gail. Incredibly chilling book.
And is it rooted in realism? Is there magic realism?
Yeah, it's hard to categorize. So it's not exactly, I wouldn't really call it magic realism. Some people have compared it to magic realism, but I think it's actually a little bit, it's very stark in that way. And I think she didn't write like this in all her other novels. Like her most famous novel is something called The Time of the Doves, which actually wrote about time during the Franco era. life in the Franco
so
era.
So she was writing this during the Franco era then?
Yes, this was probably slightly later because it was her last book.
So in like the 70s or 80s?
Possibly
or,
a bit earlier. Right. Yeah, sorry, I can't get you the exact dates. Right. But yes.
Right, post-war then.
Yes, yeah. Post-war. Ben, some people have tried to read it as a political allegory for dictatorship or for political oppression, but it kind of doesn't even fit that. I mean, it really defies all kinds of categorization, and I seem to love those kinds of books that you can't quite place. But the language, to me, and I think the translator did a great job as well, but the language is so disturbing and yet so luscious at the same time.
Just, so this is Death in Spring.
Death in Spring.
By?
Mercer Rodoreda.
Yes. Oh, great.
Published by Penguin. And I think this was it's maybe the first translation of her book of this particular book in English, just published this year.
See, you come to Bitter Culture and you get just such extremes of, you know, one end to the other.
Indeed.
You know,
yeah.
Where else can you get this kind of thing? Not, I mean, Lynn, obviously on your shows, obviously we get, anyway.
I wouldn't say so.
No? Okay. So anyway, that brings us to the end of this week's show. And only remains me now to thank special honored guest, Pauline Phan.
Thank you.
Do you have any things coming up that you want to tell the listeners about?
Well, we do have a smallish festival that we are doing in the beginning of November. It's in collaboration with JKKN, and we'll be bringing three international groups, UNESCO Traditions, Achenese Tarian Saman, Vietnamese Cha Tru music, and also some Cambodian dances.
And how do we find out about this?
Which will all be on our Facebook page in the coming weeks.
The Pusaka Facebook page?
Yes, Pusaka Facebook page.
Okay, great. And Lynn, thank you. Lichu Lynn, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Goodbye also from myself, Cam Ruslan. I would just ask you, please, to like our Facebook page because we're very sensitive here. And it hurts, quite frankly, when our numbers go down.
So how much do you enjoy stereotypes, Cam? is it fun for you?
Oh, yeah, and you think that's funny. Anyway, before we stop. A fight in here. Thank you very much, and please join us next week for another episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.